Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The National Association of School Nurses last week raised concerns about COVID safety protocols in schools and a new CDC study that revealed an increased risk of diabetes for children testing positive for COVID. The Vice President for Research at the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, Sanjoy Dutta, cautioned against undue alarm. He said more research is needed. Meanwhile, the Omicron variant has disrupted classes and schools across the country, causing many closures because of widespread student, teacher, and staff absences. Kate King is president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses and a school nurse in the Columbus City Schools World Language Middle School. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me. I'm very glad to be here today.
When you were on the show in October, Columbus City School nurses had declared a state of emergency. Nurses across the U.S. were overwhelmed with COVID cases and overworked. Has anything changed for the better at this point?
I think there are pockets where things have changed for the better. There are districts that have moved to hire help and get more personnel to help school nurses in their jobs. As you mentioned, the Omicron virus has changed the game once again. And so those increase in cases, as we know, the increase in children's cases has really made the school nurse role, again, very, very challenging.
The OEA, the Ohio Education Association, had a signed letter from, Columbus Education Association, a signed letter from many teachers in the Columbus City Schools calling for a two-week shutdown to get the variant under control. Where do the nurses stand on that?
So the nurses really are looking at what mitigation strategies and where we can assist in maintaining schools in person. You know, teachers and school nurses really want to keep children in school. We really want students to have in-person learning. The sticking point is how can we do that and do that safely for staff, students, and the greater community. And each district in Ohio and across the nation needs to make those decisions. And they need to make those decisions with transparency. What are we looking at? What criteria are we looking at? And how can we do that in a safe manner? You know, COVID has really brought to the forefront what school nurses do and how we do it. And it has also really elevated school nurses to taking care of the health of staff. And so we have to look at the health of everyone, not just the students, but the staff as well, and then how that translates out to our community. These inconsistencies across districts and counties and states of mitigation strategies and plans and what we're doing create a great confusion amongst school nurses, amongst staff, teachers, families, communities. This inconsistency really hurts us quite a bit in making sure that all of our plans are safe for everyone.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a study last week that shows a link between children who have had COVID and an increased risk in type 1 and type 2 diabetes. What data are you tracking at the school level from those students who have had COVID? Are you paying attention to that?
Well, we've just started really looking at that. I just want to be clear that the study shows an association between children with COVID and development of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. It didn't control for other variations such as obesity or poverty or any of those other factors.
Right.
And I want to be clear that a research association means that there's some data, and my phone keeps blowing up. I think people are
watching, listening,
texting me and friends. Sorry. stop texting me, everyone. But anyway, and that association means that it's not a correlation. It's not a causation. So what school nurses will be looking for is when we do have new cases of diabetes, again, asking, did your child have COVID? That's not an official nor publishable research study. But when we gather that data as school nurses, we really then can promote and encourage further research. We just really need further research on this to see if there is an actual correlation versus just an association.
Vaccination rates for those ages 5 to 11 started out slowly in Ohio, which isn't really surprising since all the vaccination trajectory has been slow in Ohio. Have they picked up the pace?
So there is still just trickling in. Columbus Public Health is now hosting a drive-through vaccine clinic again at the SLES Center. Very encouraged by that. We know that school-located vaccine clinics work. We know that. And so we really need to encourage more school-located vaccine clinics and look at that with a lens of our families who have experienced disparities. We know one-on-one conversation and counseling helps with vaccine hesitancy and answering those questions. We know that parents of kids in poverty, as well as, and I want to bring forward our new American parents, mm-hmm. have a very difficult system, a very difficult time navigating our system. NASN just put out a special edition of the NASN Journal about school-located vaccine clinics. I think that's the way to go, and that requires our community partners, our school administrations, having a school nurse at the table to make sure that we are doing this in the best manner, because school nurses have that public health expertise as well as the expertise of how school systems work.
School-located vaccine clinics sounds like a no-brainer. What's the problem?
There's resource problems. All of our providers are pretty stretched in terms of providing for the larger community and then moving that into a school. And getting consent forms from parents is also a difficult task. So I really think it has to do with more marketing, more movement into the community to bring that information to parents so we can bring it back to the schools. We also need to look at the other immunizations that kiddos are behind on. So it's not just COVID, but can we offer all of the immunizations? Because once again, we're way behind on those normal childhood vaccines, measles, which scares me, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, all of those things.
My guest is Kate King. She's president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses and a school nurse at the Columbus City Schools World Language Middle School. I said you're president-elect. You were president-elect when I talked to you last fall.
Yes. I was president-elect. We have a two-year term of president-elect moving into the presidency.
Okay.
NASN has a wide reach, and there's a lot to learn, and I'm still learning from the national organization, but I'm so excited to bring my local lens and view. Can I just say, Anne, that I was so excited to read this morning that the federal government is supplying N95 masks for free, and I'm even more excited that we're looking at child size N95 masks. We know that our small kids do not have close-fitting or well-fitting masks to come back to school after 5 days. They just don't. It's too hard for kids to wear them. And I'm so excited to see that we're looking at actual protection.
You know, I'm kind of interested in your perspective on just how children are relating to this. We hear it on the outside where the controversies are and parents say this is traumatizing their kids and stuff. But I'm kind of curious because it's an interesting kind of time for a child, too. And they're so inquisitive and have so many questions. And so I find them to be actually very adaptable. But, you know, everyone to each his own. What's it been like? How are they doing?
So our kids are doing well. There was a lot of discussion how our little ones would have difficulties. That's usually not the case. We do have difficulties finding masks that actually fit them well. But most of our little kiddos, grades five and under, do what they're told. We still have to do that continual reminder because talking, that mask just drops below their nose. Continually pulling it up, those well-fitting masks will help. We do see sometimes in our older students just that normal teenage resistance to doing anything they're told to do. Again, it's the constant reminders of moving that mask up over the nose and wearing it correctly that really takes a lot of our staff's time and resources. We need to continue to do that. What we do understand, though, is that, you know, continual close-fitting mask wearing doesn't happen all the time. We're doing the best we can, but our kiddos are really doing a pretty good job. The Omicron contagion factor is a real stickler when it comes to wearing those masks correctly for a majority of the time.
In October, you said that 30% of the students have some kind of chronic condition, asthma, diabetes, et cetera. Going forward, any sense and other things that you're looking for as far as long-term COVID after effects?
Well, of course, we're looking at the mental health aspect of COVID after effects. We have many children who have lost one or both parents to COVID, or loved ones or caregivers, aunts, grandfathers, uncles. So we are looking at that. This is just a new way of being, and it is so important that we look at those mental health effects and help children learn to cope with them. That is really one of the key factors, and help them learn how to socialize well again. You know, being home for a year is very different than being out in public for a year, and helping them to cope with socializing. And again, I think those long-term effects of COVID we have yet to see, and school nurses will be on the forefront of collecting data on that.
As you mentioned, the White House is going to start making 10 million COVID tests. Well, you mentioned the masks, but they're going to be making 10 million COVID tests available to schools each month. Is it too little too late? Or, I mean, there might what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm glad they're doing it now. Do I wish they had done it quite some time ago? I certainly do. But I'm glad they're doing it now. What we're finding is higher absence rates with kids, which parents are keeping kids home with symptoms, which we've told them to do, but they have no way to test those children. So they come back to school when their symptoms are gone. Do we know if they had COVID? We don't. And so we're vastly probably underreporting how many positives we do have, because parents just have not had access to tests. In fact, I had one parent, myself, send a child with symptoms early in the morning to come to see me, because they knew through our partnership with Nationwide Children's Hospital that I could swab and test them if they were symptomatic. And that's what the parent told me. I'm like, I just sent your kid to school with symptoms. Well, because I knew you could test them. And that is not any sort of blame on the parent. That indicates what the shortage of testing does. And so I'm so glad that we're going to see more testing results. But coupled with that will be education and help for parents to do those tests correctly and to get those results reported or back to their schools. Again, anytime we have this new product, or it's not new, but more, we need to couple that with help and assistance for our parents.
Another thing is your association has highlighted the importance and need for upgraded ventilation systems. There is money earmarked for this. What is your sense about how compliant schools are, especially in older districts with older buildings?
Well, I think everyone is making the attempt to do so. I know from beginning COVID that people who understand ventilation systems in school districts may also be lacking, and how to do that, and how to do that in old buildings. And so I believe everyone is making a great concerted effort. I'm not sure that we have enough knowledge out there, and again, enough personnel who know what they're doing to be able to make those changes across the country. And we know that school systems move slowly. So getting that up to speed, I think, is something that we're really focusing on.
Kate King, thanks so much for your time again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann.
Kate King is president-elect of the National Association of School Nurses and a school nurse at Columbus City Schools World Language Middle School. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
My dad was on his deathbed. I mean, my dad's prognosis early on was very, very, very bad. And the doctors have done everything in their power to keep him alive.
That's David Bennett Jr. speaking to reporters last week after his father's successful and historic heart transplant surgery using a genetically modified pig heart. The 8-hour operation at the University of Maryland Medical Center caps years of work by scientists to develop pig organs compatible with the human body, but it also raises serious ethical and medical concerns. Professor Brendan Parent is Director of Transplant Ethics and Policy Research at NYU Grossman School of Medicine and is leading research that explores the ethics of xenotransplantation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're of the position that this surgery occurred too quickly, that medical science, and I guess the ethical arm of that, isn't ready to take this step.
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
Why?
We have a lot of decades of research into xenotransplant that has been focused on transplanting from one non-human species into another non-human species. And this is very much the first of its kind with a genetically edited pig organ put into a human being. And the data that we have so far doesn't necessarily support that this is going to be better than even the alternative for this individual, which would have been, could have been palliative care measures. I'm just not sure. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, so where would that data come from if they don't do it?
So the data could come from trials in mechanically supported deceased humans where the organs are connected and tested in a human environment without having risks for living human beings.
And that's medically possible.
It is medically possible, and it is taking place in other contexts.
So let's talk about the comparison. So, David Bennett Sr. has received this genetically modified pig heart, and you're saying that the data is not there to support whether or not traditional palliative care, in other words, doing nothing but treating except for the palliative treatments. We don't know if it's going to work. In other words, he might die. He might not. This might not succeed. It's succeeded so far, but that's just temporary.
Yeah, it's possible. And again, I'm not saying that it won't work, and I have every hope that it will, especially for this individual. Mm-hmm. But it is possible that this transplant could lead to rejections, which could have more profound health consequences, which could be more painful, more difficult for him. And I think more importantly, he has the right to take that risk. It's what he was told and how he was engaged in understanding his options.
And you're not satisfied that things were explained properly to him?
I'm not sure. I just haven't seen. I've asked the questions, and the questions are, well, what was the consent like? What did he agree to? What did he know were the options here versus what else he could have done?
Along with all of the medical data from this first of a kind transplant, I guess xenotransplantation, do they share typically those kinds of issues, those kinds of details?
When the procedures are done, yes, these kinds of protocols should be available, especially when it's research, right? This is how we share information, how we better understand and make it possible to do it right going forward.
With the xenotransplantations between other animals, not non-human, were they also dealing with genetically modified organs?
Yes. So some of this work has been done, right, when transplanting into non-human primates. Yes.
And why do the organs have to be genetically modified? How so?
There was a protein that was lost in the evolutionary chain, which means that when a non-human organ is put into a human being, the human's body automatically attacks it and rejects it as something unfamiliar. This even happens between human beings, right?
Right.
But because we have immunosuppression and we have better ability to match according to blood type and antigens, we can make these organs last for a while. But that rejection response is far more profound across species. So the pig organ has to be modified to be more acceptable to the human body.
Is this the first xenotransplantation into a human of any organ, right?
It's the first genetically edited xenotransplant. Over hundreds of years, occasional pioneer surgeon scientists have attempted this. You might remember Baby Faye back in the 80s who received a baboon heart.
Oh, that's right.
This was a young child who didn't have any other options, and she didn't survive for very long. And so that possibly set the whole field back a number of years.
What are the other ethical issues about this? Is there, when they genetically modify, are they growing pigs? They're not, this isn't just, they're genetically modifying an entire pig, right?
That's correct. Yep. So these pigs are being raised specifically for the purpose of being killed so that their organs can be put into human beings.
Which raises a whole nother host of sci-fi type questions, right?
Right, absolutely. And a lot of people point to the fact that, you know, hundreds of millions of pigs are killed every year for human consumption. Why is this, you know, any worse or different, right? In fact, it's better because we're actually saving human lives. And that's true. But perhaps we have to question sort of the whole enterprise of raising, you know, pigs as source animals for human use.
The slippery slope of all of that is raising humans for that use.
Yes, that's definitely the sci-fi concern that goes into the future. But even here, you know, we have to wonder whether this is sort of the sustainable future that we want. We don't have enough organs for all people who need these transplants, right? And so scientists say, hey, if we can grow pigs, then we don't have to take them out of dead people, and we can have a sustainable source of organs. And the question is, well, how sustainable is it if we are, you know, bringing these pigs into existence so that we can kill them to save human lives?
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Brendan Parent. He's Director of Transplant Ethics and Policy Research at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. He provides ethics consultation for transplant programs across the U.S. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When they genetically modify a pig for this purpose, is it just, could they ostensibly use a pig's lungs for transplant, or is it specifically for the heart or the liver or whatever it might be?
So we're focusing, and by we, the teams that are doing the xenotransplant research are focusing on hearts and kidneys because those organs are more well-matched to the human body in some ways in terms of size and shape. Lungs would probably be a bit more complicated, but it's not completely out of the question.
Why pigs?
Yeah, interestingly, it just, we happen to be more compatible with pigs in some ways biologically. Pigs also have a short gestation period, so it makes it possible to grow them fairly quickly. And they can be pretty well managed in contained environments.
Following the surgery, news outlets reported that David Bennett Sr. was convicted of stabbing a man in 1988 and paralyzing that man. The family of the victim, Edward Shoemaker, is outraged that Bennett received this life-saving procedure. Does something like a criminal background or something like that have a place in the discussion who gets organ transplants?
I have incredible sympathy for the family of the victim, but when it comes to organ transplant and deciding who is eligible, it's not the place of medicine to decide who is worth saving in that regard. All that matters is who would survive with this organ, who would benefit. There's a criminal justice system for determining, blame in terms of crime.
The organ shortage. Can you talk about that and why it is labeled acute at this point?
Yeah, so there are over 100,000 people in the United States waiting for a life-saving organ transplant every day. Several people die because they don't have access. It's acute and has been for quite a long time. With the COVID crisis, more organs are failing. And so more people need them. But we've been in this place in terms of the organ shortage for quite a while, even if it might be exacerbated at this moment.
You know, this is sort of, I guess, parallel to the question I had about David Bennett Sr. And his, you know, the fact that he killed somebody and whether that makes him worthy or unworthy. This is probably popping up and around the dinner table of people who have been waiting for a lung in particular that have nothing to do with COVID, that have had, in fact, they have been some of the most isolated people in the country right now, because if anything happens, if COVID hits them, they're extremely vulnerable. They're waiting. What about the question of who gets in line first? If you have two equal patients, one of whom did not get vaccinated and got COVID and ruined their lungs. And thankfully, we hope the stage is over with, at least at this point, because of the vaccinations. But somebody who did not get vaccinated could have. And somebody who has had to isolate for months, years now because of COVID.
Now, the questions around fairness and who has access to organ transplant, they're difficult. They're difficult. But I'll say again that the most important factors for any transplant program when deciding who should have access to life-saving care, when that care is limited, has to do with who is going to survive, who it would benefit, right? And if there are indications that the person wouldn't benefit because they wouldn't be taking care of their body afterward, i.e. that organ would fail because of actions or inaction that that person takes, i.e. that they haven't shown that they can follow up with their immune suppression regimen, that they don't come into doctor's appointments, you know, that kind of information potentially could be used to, you know, make a decision that that organ could go somewhere else. So when it comes to vaccination, there are some transplant programs across the nation that are requiring COVID vaccination in order to be listed for transplant. And it isn't that much different than all of the other vaccinations, which are required to be listed.
Okay. Interesting. Surgeons in New York several months ago attached the kidney of a genetically engineered pig to a brain dead person. You were talking about that earlier. What did they learn about that kidney and how that responded in that case?
So when that kidney was hooked up, it started to produce urine and it wasn't rejected for close to 2 days, maybe even a little over 2 days. Which was pretty good preliminary evidence that the body was accepting that kidney and that it could work for longer. And so additional research would be useful before it would be put into a living human who would need that to save their life.
So as far as the ethics of this type of transplantation, you received a grant to study all of this. What are you shooting for here? What are your research goals?
We want to understand, one, what the public thinks about xenotransplant, if people are ready mentally and emotionally for this as a treatment option. We want to make sure that the right considerations are put into who will be the first humans who would receive these. Right. One angle is that we should only give the first xenotransplants to people who are otherwise ineligible for other organs, just like the case in Maryland, because it would be their last option, last opportunity. They have no other choices. But those people are more vulnerable. They're more desperate. And the data that would come out of those operations wouldn't necessarily be easily applied to people who are more healthy. Right. We want to make sure that populations have access to life-saving treatment equally, but that perhaps certain populations which have a history of being marginalized or disadvantaged, even in the medical context, are not used as guinea pigs for this kind of operation. And finally, we also want to get back to the questions about sort of non-human animal considerations and when and whether animals that live, breathe, have feelings that go beyond just the reception of pain, that the rights are considered in contrast to the rights and well-being of humans.
Yeah, I wondered about the animal rights and whether advocates, animal rights advocates, have gotten involved in this conversation.
They have. And, you know, there's, as with any advocacy issue, there's a range of perceptions, right? Some people are saying, well, at least they're going to save human lives, right? And then there are others who say, this is another example of taking advantage of killing sentient beings for human benefit. And then we shouldn't do this. Then there are some who say, well, these pigs, if we're going to be using their organs, we have to take good care of them, right? So they have really enriched environments. They get, you know, good diet. They have toys in their play area until they're, you know, killed for their organs. There are even some who say, you know what? Why don't we just use one kidney from the pig and let it be a living donor, right? So that way you actually don't even have to kill the pig. Well, donor implies consent, and obviously the pigs are not consenting to their kidneys.
Well, and then what happens if somebody needs a heart? I mean,
exactly.
It just seems like they'd be eventually just kept around.
Right.
That the only the benefit of taking just one kidney is it could keep them alive until they want another kidney or a heart or something else.
Yep, that's true. And I will say that the ultimate goal, what's our ultimate goal in the field of organ transplant? Well, it'd be nice if we didn't have to take any living, breathing thing or even from a deceased human being, right? That we had enough organs to go around. And eventually that means bioengineering, building organs from scratch so that if Anne or Brendan needed an organ, take a little sample of our cells and then grow. And maybe pigs are a stepping stone to that point.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you next but can it be a stepping stone without also doing the xenotransplantations?
And that's a question. I think it would be very difficult to get there without starting with editing the pig models. You take an existing organism, you modify it, you learn from that, and then eventually we can build up the science and infrastructure to grow organs from scratch. But as long as we don't get stopped, you know, and say, we got the pigs, that's all we need, we're set here, that we can actually progress to the next steps.
Wow. Brendan Parent, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Brendan Parent is Director of Transplant Ethics and Policy Research at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, and we have been talking about the ethics of that 8-hour operation at the University of Maryland Medical Center last week. It was an historic heart transplant surgery using a genetically modified pig that was transplanted into a human male. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the early days of the pandemic, millions shifted from congregant gym time to at-home workouts or no workouts at all. And that's a problem if you're anxious about the pandemic. A new Swedish study published in the Frontiers in Psychiatry suggests that physical activity reduces the risk of developing clinical anxiety. New York Times Well Blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds wrote about the research in a recent column titled, How Exercise May Tame Our Anxiety. Welcome back, Gretchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm pretty sure I've told you before, I definitely, you know, I don't exercise for the smoking hot body anymore. It's about stress, strong bones, and strength.
me too. And I think more so than ever in the last couple of years, it has helped a lot of us maintain some degree of sanity. And this new study just reemphasizes how important it can be to get out and move. And in this case, it's a huge study by scientific standards. They looked at more than almost 200,000 people who had done a cross-country ski race in Sweden, where they like cross-country ski races. And then they also looked at another 200,000 Swedish people who had not done this race. And doing this race requires that you, in effect, have a healthy lifestyle, that you're training, you're eating well. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're, you know, an absolute monster athlete. It basically means that you must be quite active. And when they then looked at whether the people over the next 20 years, this is a long-term study, whether people were diagnosed with clinical anxiety disorders, the people who had done this race just once were half as likely to have developed anxiety as the other Swedes. And that's a pretty big difference. And it does add to a really large body of evidence that moving, particularly if you can manage to get outside, but even if not, being in motion has a really strong effect on our mental health. And it's been true for depression. Now this is true for clinical anxiety. It's true for anger. It's true for resilience. And in the face of yet another COVID winter, I think this study is really empowering because it does suggest, and the authors told me they do not think you have to go out and do a cross-country ski race. It's great if you know, have access to snow and you have access to the equipment because that's fun, but it almost certainly is true that if you can get up and move around, you are going to be better able to cope with all the things that are going on right now.
Were there any differences in gender or age or anything like that?
It was interesting that by and large, there were not. And it was pretty almost half and half men and women. And for the most part, and a wide range of ages from 18 through 80. And by and large, almost everyone who did this race got the same benefit, except the very fastest women, which was interesting. Hmm. And the authors think it might be that these women felt particular anxiety about whether they were going to win, that the competition actually increased their anxiety. So it is worth considering if you want to race. It's certainly not necessary for some of us, and it looks like for women, the competitive pressure may be enough to actually slightly increase your chance of feeling anxious. But even then, these fast women still had much less risk of anxiety than the people who were not doing this activity at all. They were just slightly more anxious than some of the other racers.
And again, this is on top of a long body of research correlating at least anxiety and exercise or lack thereof, right?
Yes, it is. And this is both that there's been past research that physical activity can both prevent, which is what this study was about, preventing anxiety and other mental health issues. But it also can, a big body of evidence suggests, treat the conditions if you develop them. And for those of us who've been feeling more depressed than we did 2 years ago, certainly this is my anecdotal experience and probably yours. When I feel the lowest, when it seems like the pandemic will never end and everything else is closing in, if I get up, take my dogs, go for a walk, it makes all the difference in my ability to cope. And the vast body of evidence, scientific evidence, suggests this is true for virtually everyone.
Aerobic exercise is key here, right?
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, I've written a number of studies in the past that have shown the same from weight training.
Okay.
It makes people feel stronger. It seems to change aspects of your brain. It really does look like almost anything. And that means go to the gym, go for a walk, get up, hop around in your living room. That can actually change aspects of your brain that make it so much easier to cope with difficult conditions.
And that makes you healthier physically too, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is just that it's hardly an add-on that it makes you feel better emotionally. But the fact of the matter is, exercise is one of the best things you can possibly do for yourself right now because it does have enormous effects on your health. A study I wrote about last year found that people who were fit, physically fit, who met the guidelines for exercise, which is 4 or 5 times a week going for a walk for 30 minutes, were far, far less likely to wind up hospitalized with COVID than people who did not exercise that much. And this was before we had the vaccinations, but still that's a huge effect on your health, your likelihood to get sick. And then it also very clearly has effects on your ability to cope emotionally with conditions now.
So if we aren't able to cross country ski because we live in Central Ohio, I know you're in Arizona. Central Ohio is not much better when it comes to the climate, when it comes to skiing. But anyways, the World Health Organization has recommendations for other things you can do.
Go for a walk. The formal recommendations from both the World Health Organization and the American guidelines are try to get out, and you don't have to get outside, but there is some evidence that it has a greater impact on your mental health. Try to exercise for about 30 minutes, and that can be a brisk walk, at least 4 to 5 times a week. And if you can manage that, that there's really good evidence that that has an enormous impact on your risk for a broad variety of diseases, but also lowers your risk of dying by 30, 40, 50% compared to people who do not dying of dying prematurely. You will almost certainly live a longer, healthier life if you manage to get out and walk at least a few times a week right now.
I know that a lot of what you do has been, you know, individual. You were a runner. I don't know if you're still doing it or not, but a lot of people were into boot camps, gym settings, that kind of a thing. And that's part of what brings them joy is the group therapy of that. Any thoughts about that?
Again, is very clear evidence that the social aspect of a lot of this exercise is really important to people and is important for both emotional and physical benefits of exercise. And that is hard right now. If you have a friend who you know has been vaccinated and is taking all precautions, you can certainly get together and go outside for a walk together, masked or not. But there also are more options online right now than probably before the pandemic. And a lot of them are free. It's not quite the same, but you can join a class. And a lot of them, if they're online, they will actually show sort of pictures of everyone who's part of the class, so you feel more a part of that. It does require a little more effort for people who want to be part of a class to find the right opportunity. Because right now, by and large, it's not a good idea to go to classes where people are indoors and breathing heavily, but you can find varieties of that online. And again, most of them right now are still free.
And another issue, there is encouraging news for those who have had a long layoff from working out. A new study suggests that our muscles remember. And I certainly, I'm a big believer in this because I've had different episodes throughout my last 20 years of that. We've heard about muscle memory. How does that play out, what's the science behind that? What do we mean by that?
I actually found that one of the most encouraging studies I've written about recently, because it builds on research that was done in people, although the study I wrote about was in mice. But both the human and the animal studies found that our muscle cells, the genes in our muscle cells, actually change when we, in this case, they were looking at weight training in mice and in people, and it changes the operations of certain genes. They start working differently. And in the mice, those changes lingered for the equivalent of years. It would be as if you had been an athlete in college and then quit for the next 10, 20 years, and then returned to the gym. And the genes that had started working differently before still work differently in ways that allow you to add muscle mass and strength much faster than if you had never done that workout. So those of us who our exercise might have fallen off a cliff during the pandemic, your body and your muscles and your genes remember how to get fit. I mean, they literally remember. They have a memory built into the genes now. It will come back faster than you think. So it's worth it, no matter how much time you've taken off. Go for a walk, go back to the gym, do something. And if you've never done it before, the other thing was these mice were at least adults and they started adding memories. So it's never too late to start changing how your body works.
But assuming you have muscle memory, you don't want to overdo it if you're just getting back to it after a long absence anyways.
Of course, you always start slowly. You have muscle memory, but you can still pull that muscle really easily. So start slowly, do what feels comfortable, do what you enjoy, because that's the one thing that's going to get you to keep coming back and doing it over and over.
And yet, and we're running out of time, but yet another benefit of exercise and regular exercise. You had a December 2021 column about a study of American adults that find that active, physically fit men and women are more than twice as likely to be moderate or heavy drinkers as people who are out of shape, which seems like,
Yes, and it may be because people think, oh, I just went for a run. I can have as much beer as I want. The correlation is interesting. That the one thing that I tried to stress in writing about that was that there definitely was a correlation between being fit and being a moderate drinker. There was not nearly as much of correlation with really heavy drinking. So if you are exercising, be aware of how much you're drinking, but you probably don't need to worry about, the levels of alcohol too much.
Gretchen Reynolds, thanks as always for your time. I always appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds is a columnist for the New York Times Well blog, and we talk about exercise a lot with Gretchen. Thanks to everybody else out there for listening. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.